So we shall start slowly and take our time. And it's a great pleasure to have someone from Bordeaux. I mean, who made it to Paris. You arrived yesterday, I guess.
Yeah.
And Cyril will tell us about the fear behavior, I mean, and the prefrontal interneurons. I mean, the one we just spoke about a few minutes ago, I guess, the PNNs. Okay. So Cyril, I mean, take your time. I mean, it can be a bit lengthy at the beginning so that we have time to see the people around.
Okay. So I first like to thank Alain for the kind invitation to this exciting symposium. Based on your introduction, I understood that most of the people will discuss about the role of PNN surrounding fast-spiking interneurons in cortical plasticity. Although I have some interest in the past to PNN, more in the amygdala, but today I won't talk about PNN activity. So today my talk will be more focused on the functional role of fast-spiking interneurons in the cortex during fear behavior. Of course, I'm convinced that PNN can really modulate the activity of fast-spiking interneurons and can play a role also in this phenomenon. Here I'm more concerned about synchronization of activity among pyramidal neurons in the cortex and the role of fast-spiking interneurons in this process. So before to go into the detail of the work we have done recently in Bordeaux, I just want to introduce the global idea I want to work on in my lab. So in this scheme, you have a network composed of different kind of neuron, excitatory inhibitory neuron, that may receive sensory inputs, that process these inputs and somehow produce a behavioral output. Sorry. And the main question we are interested in my lab is how to relate the plasticity that develops in this circuit to behavioral learning. And to address this question, we use a really simple, although really robust behavioral paradigm that is auditory fear conditioning, during which you associate a tone, a conditioned stimulus like a tone, with a mild aversive foot shock called the US unconditioned stimulus. And during the association between the tone and the shock, the CS and the US, the animal learns that the CS predicts the foot shock. And the next time you will present the CS alone, the animal will display a broad range of conditioned fear responses, including a typical fear responses called freezing behavior, that is the immobilization of the animal. So really simple model. There is few things we know about the neuronal circuits involved in fear behavior, in particularly auditory fear conditioning. It's the role of two main structures, the basolateral amygdala and the medial prefrontal cortex. The basolateral amygdala is known to encode the association between the CS and the US, process this information, and the prefrontal cortex is known to regulate the expression of fear behavior. Especially two regions in the prefrontal cortex, the ventral prefrontal cortex is involved in fear inhibition. In contrast, the dorsal part of the prefrontal cortex, including the cingulate cortex and the prelimbic area, is involved in the modulation of fear expression. So basically, some studies in the past have revealed that if you perform dorsal prefrontal cortex inactivation, you block fear expression, freezing expression. In contrast, if you perform electrical stimulation of this region, you will enhance freezing responses. And some study in the Quirk lab and Marin lab have shown that in the prefrontal cortex, you have some neurons which activity correlates with freezing behavior. However, we know that these two structures are involved. We know some neurons show correlation with fear behavior, but the detailed neural circuits involved in the prefrontal cortex is still largely unknown. And that was the main topic of my lab over the past few years. So today I will discuss two main topics we have covered in my lab over the past few years. The first one is related to the functional role of parvalbumin-expressing interneurons in the control of fear behavior. And the second part is dealing with temporal encoding of fear behavior by prefrontal neuronal assemblies. This second part is not really related to the function of fast-spiking interneurons, but we are using some tools. We manipulate prefrontal interneurons to regulate the activity of principal neurons. So in the first part is more the function of fast-spiking interneurons. In the second part is more we use them as a tool to modulate neuronal activity. And I start with the first part of my presentation. So in the prefrontal cortex, like in any other cortices, you have two main kind of neurons, excitatory neuron, projection neurons, and inhibitory interneurons. And particularly the paravalbumin-expressing interneurons are quite known because they control precisely the activity of principal neurons, either by contacting the axon ALOC or the soma of the neurons. And they can really be precisely controlling the activity of principal neurons, of projection neurons. So it's what I'm just saying. They control the activity of principal neurons at subcellular levels, and they contact principally the soma and the axon. So in this first project, we ask what is the role of prefrontal inhibitory interneuron, in particular fast-spiking interneurons, or I would say paravalbumin-expressing interneurons in the control of fear behavior? And to address this question, we use electrophysiology, in vivo electrophysiology, single units recording. The general idea is that you implant electrode in the structure of interest, in our case the dorsal prefrontal cortex, and you record the extracellular activity of those neurons. And those neurons, the action potential they emit, they have a particular shape depending on the neurons you are recording. And based on this shape, you can establish cluster of action potential that belongs to a single cell. And you can follow like this the activity of single neurons during behavior. So that's the main technique we are using in the lab, combined with optogenetic as well. So in terms of behavior, this is a typical fear conditioning experiment where we use a discriminative fear conditioning. What does it mean? We use two different sounds, what we call the CS minus and the CS plus. They are completely different. The CS plus is not associated with the foot shock during conditioning, but the CS plus is associated with the foot shock. So before conditioning, the CS minus is always in blue here and the CS plus in red. We quantify the level of freezing in those animals before conditioning. So the baseline level of freezing is roughly 20%. There is no difference between CS minus and CS plus. In contrast, after fear conditioning, what you see is that the animal discriminate at the behavioral level between the sound that has been associated with the foot shock from the sound that has not been associated with the foot shock. Eventually, if you present the sound, the CS plus alone, you will get what we call an extinction of the behavior. And if you wait enough time, you will see the recovery of fear behavior with time. Okay, so we have done recordings in the prefrontal cortex using this behavior, and mainly in the cingulate cortex in the prelimbic area. So in this project, we recorded like 700 neurons in this structure, and we first observed that 70% of both neurons recorded were tone reactive. They respond either to the CS minus or to the CS plus. So the first thing we did was to try to separate excitatory principal neuron from inhibitory neuron using unsupervised cluster algorithm based on three electrophysiological criteria of those neuron. That is the firing frequency of the neuron, the spike half width, and the area under the peak that is supposed to correspond to the after hyperpolarization of action potentials. So using this unbiased approach, we were able to separate two clusters of neurons, particularly putative excitatory projection neurons and putative inhibitory interneurons. And I will focus for the first part of my presentation on the interneurons, and particularly those guys you see here and here that have high firing frequency and that are likely fast-spiking interneurons. Okay, so from those data, we observed that we get back the percentage of excitatory neuron and inhibitory neuron we usually find in the cortex, 70% of excitatory neuron, between 20 and 30% of inhibitory interneurons. And what we did first, we tried looking at the interneurons, we tried to identify firing patterns during fear behavior. So we use a principal component analysis to dissociate the different firing patterns. And we found two main firing patterns for those putative inhibitory interneurons. The first firing pattern is an activation following the tone onset, the CS onset. The second pattern is a strong inhibition. So this is just the principal component analysis. This is an example of such neuron. We call them type 1 excited, type 2 inhibited. Type 1 are strongly excited, as you see here, when you present the sound. And type 2 are strongly inhibited. this is examples, and here are the population of neurons we have been characterizing using this approach. We got 68 type 1 interneurons, excited interneurons, and 15 type 2 interneurons that are inhibited. So what you can see already from these two populations is that they display antagonist firing patterns. So this may suggest, and I will come back to that later on, that type 1 interneuron may inhibit type 2 interneuron. I come back to that in a moment. So what do we know about these type 1 and type 2 putative interneurons? First, we look at whether anatomically they were segregated or intermixed, and what we observe is that there was no particular anatomical location where we recorded these type 1 and type 2 interneurons. What we observe, in contrast, is that in terms of firing rate, type 2 interneuron display a high firing rate, in average around 50 Hertz compared to type 1 interneurons. And this is the classical discrimination between what we call regular versus fast spiking interneurons. So we have type 1 interneurons excited, type 2 inhibited. And one characteristic of fast spiking interneurons that has been described in the literature is that they are modulated by theta oscillation. So first, what we did, we looked whether those two, type 1 and type 2 interneurons, were modulated by theta oscillation. And we observed that type 1 was strongly modulated by theta oscillation recorded in the prefrontal cortex. This is maybe more obvious on this spectrogram, where you see the clear band of activation around 10 Hertz for the type 2 interneurons. So based on those data, this was suggestive that type 1 interneurons are non-parvalbuminergic expressing interneurons, whereas type 2 interneurons are parvalbumin expressing interneurons. So, sorry, I don't know why I went back to the beginning. Okay, so this is based on recordings we have done, but we were not fully satisfied by this approach, and we wanted to be more demonstrative that type 2 are indeed PV-expressing interneurons. So we switched to an optogenetic strategy, and we use Cre PV mice. Indeed, these are mice that express the Cre recombinase under the control of the promoter of parvalbumin-expressing interneurons, PV interneurons. And we perform a conditional expression of an opsin, a proton pump, the Archer rhodopsin, that under light exposure, under yellow light exposure, induce an hyperpolarization of the neuron and an inhibition of the neuron. So using this strategy, what we observe, this is the control condition. We have one type 2 interneuron here. If we switch, if you don't have light, you don't see any effect. But as soon as you switch on the light, that is, you see this strong effect, the strong inhibition of the interneuron, indicating that this particular interneuron indeed is a PV-expressing interneuron. So this is an example. This is the number we collected at the end in this story. We get even more. But we have five type 2 interneurons that were clearly identified. And in contrast, when you do the same thing with type 1 interneurons, we clearly see that they are not reactive to the light presentation, so they are not PV-expressing interneurons. So what I'm saying here is that we type 2 but not type 1 interneurons express the parvalbumin. So I'm not saying that all PV interneurons are type 2 interneurons. If you look at this data, what we observe is that we find these five interneurons that are type 2 interneurons, and basically based on their activity during the tone presentation, they are strongly inhibited. But we were also able to identify other PV-expressing interneurons that were not modulated during freezing behavior. So I think we are the type 2 interneurons do not cover the entire population of PV interneurons. It's just a subset. That was the point of what I wanted to say. So the conclusion here is that type 2 interneurons correspond to a functional class of PV-expressing interneurons. I mentioned earlier that type 1 interneurons may inhibit type 2 interneuron mainly because one was excited and the other one was inhibited. So we perform two control experiments here to try to identify this possibility. And first, if you align the type 1 and type 2 interneuron, the latency of activation or of inhibition, you see there is almost a perfect match between the two, suggesting that type 1 can indeed inhibit type 2 interneurons. We did another experiment in which we consider type 1 and type 2 interneurons recorded in the same animal, and we look at the latency of activation and inhibition of both type 1 and type 2. What we observe is that in terms of latency, type 1 interneurons were always excited before the inhibition of type 2 interneuron, again suggesting that type 1 can inhibit type 2 interneurons. Okay, so what those interneurons are doing during fear behavior, actually. So this is type 1, type 2. And now I will split the data based on the response of the neuron during the CS minus, the control sound, and the CS plus, that is the sound associated with the food shock. What you see is that we get a strong increase for type 1 interneuron during CS plus presentation in comparison to CS minus presentation. And that was the same for type 2, a strong inhibition during CS plus compared to CS minus presentation. This is another way to plot the data. Here you have in gray the freezing behavior during CS minus and CS plus, so no freezing, high freezing. And superposed to this, you get the firing activity of type 1 and type 2 interneurons. So you see that type 1 interneurons correlate with freezing behavior. Their activity strongly correlates with freezing behavior. In contrast, type 2 interneurons are inversely correlated with freezing behavior. When freezing behavior is high, they are inhibited. When it's low, they are activated. So type 1 interneurons correlate, whereas type 2 interneurons are inversely correlated with fear behavior. The next question we asked in this project was to know whether the changes in neuronal activity we observe in those type 2 interneurons was a consequence or was causing freezing behavior. That was an important question for us. And we used the following strategy. The sound we are using in our behavioral paradigm are not pure sound, they are pips. So they go like peep, 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 peep. We have 27 pips in a single sound. We can, of course, extract the freezing period within the sound presentation, represented by the arrow here, and we can extract, of course, the pips inside the freezing presentation, outside of the freezing presentation, or just before the freezing presentation. The rationale here is that if the changes in neuronal activity mediate freezing behavior, this should be obvious if we consider the first beep before freezing behavior. And that's indeed what we observe. If you consider the pips inside the freezing, we find back the inhibition of type 2 interneurons. If you consider the pips outside of the freezing, we don't see the inhibition. However, when you consider the pips just before, the first beep before the freezing behavior, we get back the inhibition. This was an example, this is the quantification, and this clearly indicates that the tone-evoked neuronal changes we observe in type 2 interneurons precede and therefore predict conditioned fear responses. So this was the first demonstration. Now we switch to an optogenetic strategy to demonstrate that the manipulation of PV expressing interneurons, the type 2 interneurons, indeed is able to modulate fear behavior. The first strategy is again using ArchT, so we try to inhibit the interneurons during fear behavior. So there is two tests we perform here. We perform a test before conditioning, and this is what you see here. So spontaneously, if you inhibit the PV interneurons, the type 2, what we call the PV interneurons at least, before conditioning, you spontaneously increase freezing behavior. The next experiment we did was to condition the animal to do an extinction of the behavior, and when the fear was extinguished, to again inhibit these PV interneurons, and what we observe is the recovery of conditioned fear responses. The next experiment we have done is the opposite. We use channel rhodopsin to activate the PV interneurons. So this time we condition the animal, we test the fear behavior, so the animal freezes at 80%, and as soon as you switch on the light, you see you get a decrease of freezing behavior. And this was not long-lasting because the next day the animals were not different. So the conclusion of this is that the inhibition of PV-expressing interneurons is necessary and sufficient to drive fear expression. Okay, what is the functional relevance of this prefrontal inhibitory circuit? So this is a model we have in mind, is that we have two conditions, the CS minus and the CS plus, and we have three kinds of neurons, basically. Type 1 interneurons, type 2 interneurons, and projection neurons. During CS minus presentation, when the fear is low, type 1 interneurons are not really activated, so type 2 interneurons are not really inhibited, and therefore the consequence on projection neurons is fairly low. In contrast, during CS plus presentation, type 1 interneurons are strongly activated, they inhibit type 2 interneurons, and this inhibition on type 2 interneurons induce a disinhibition of projection neurons. This is the model, and now I will show you the real data for the projection neurons that we collected. So if you look at the firing activity following the tone presentation, the CS plus and the CS minus for the projection neurons, we observe a stronger increase of activity during CS plus presentation, and this is consistent with the disinhibitory hypothesis that I was pushing forward in this scheme. So we, of course, there is two things that we need to demonstrate here. First, that type 2 interneurons really contact projection neurons. And secondly, that it is a real disinhibitory phenomenon we see here. So the first control is that we manipulate PV interneurons while recording projection neurons. So you have the activity of a projection neurons during tone presentation. And as you see, as soon as we activate PV interneurons, we block the activity of this principal neuron. So there is indeed a strong contact connectivity between the PV interneurons and pyramidal neurons in the prefrontal cortex. And this is the average of the data. So the second thing was to demonstrate the disinhibitory mechanism. And what we have done here is that we recorded principal neurons, but this time we inhibited PV expressing interneurons. So in the control condition with no light, the principal neuron is not doing anything, but as soon as you inhibit the PV interneurons, you get a disinhibition of the principal neuron. And this is again the the average data. So the conclusion here is that the inhibition of PV expressing interneurons disinhibits prefrontal principal neuron during fear expression. Okay, this is an interesting observation. This is an example for a pyramidal neuron, an excitatory neuron in the prefrontal cortex. So during CS minus in blue or CS plus presentation. So what you see, of course, we got a disinhibition when we presented the CS plus, as you see here. But there is a second interesting phenomenon we observe, is that these neurons start to oscillate, kind of oscillate, and in a frequency of around 10 Hertz. This is another example of showing the same thing. In this case, we have a single animal in which we recorded 9 neurons during CS minus and CS plus. And this is a single peep presentation. What you see for the CS minus is nothing. But as soon as you present the CS plus, you see the neurons start to be activated and they start to oscillate around 10 Hertz. So what is the underlying mechanism for this oscillatory pattern we observe in principal neurons? So, of course, with this technique of single units recording, we can also record simultaneously the local field potential that corresponds to the synaptic inputs to the neurons. And if you do so, what you observe is that during CS minus presentation, you have an oscillation that is not changing, not affected by the tone presentation. In contrast, in the CS plus presentation, you see that we get an increase in the oscillation, and there is a nice match between this oscillation between 8 and 12 Hertz and the firing activity of the neuron. This is a single peep. Now I will show you the data for the entire 27 peeps for a sound presentation. What we see here, so we have two graphs here for the low fear condition and high fear condition, CS minus, CS plus. What we look at is the local field potential evoked by each peep presentation. So you have a superimposition of 27 local field potential. What you see for the CS minus, there is nothing particular happening. For the CS plus, we observe the strong increase in the amplitude of the oscillation, but we also observe that there is a resetting of the phase of the oscillation in the sense that you see this nice peak just after the sound presentation. This is just the quantification of this resetting of the oscillation. So the conclusion here is that tone presentation during high fear states induce a phase resetting of theta oscillation. Okay, the obvious question we ask next was, what is the origin of this theta oscillation in the prefrontal cortex? Theta oscillation have been linked to the hippocampus, so we're wondering whether there was a direct transmission of this theta oscillation from the hippocampus. So, or the opposite hypothesis would be that the generation of the theta oscillation is more local. So we perform inhibition mucimol inactivation of the lateral septum, a structure involved in the medial septum, a structure involved in the genesis of theta oscillation. And in terms of behavior, we look at the effect on behavior before the injection, during the injection, and after the injection. In terms of behavior, when you inactivate the medial septum, you don't see any effect on freezing behavior, although we see a reduction of the amplitude of theta oscillation recorded in the hippocampus. So this is quantified here. In the hippocampus, if you inactivate the medial septum, you get a reduction of the theta oscillation. This is the quantification. What is the effect of the reduction of theta oscillation on the oscillation we observe in the prefrontal cortex? Nothing. So basically, it says that you can impact the theta oscillation in the hippocampus. This does not affect the resetting of the theta oscillation in the prefrontal cortex. So this suggests that the resetting of the theta oscillation we observe in the prefrontal cortex is not related to the hippocampus. So where does it come from? So we next investigated whether the manipulation of the PV interneurons, and we thought about the type 2 interneurons, could be related to the genesis of this oscillation. So this is a control condition. Again, we look at the local field potential, and we either inhibit or activate the PV interneurons. So no light, nothing, of course. And this is a really interesting graph. If you look at the local field potential, as soon as you inhibit the PV interneurons, you see the genesis of this oscillation. And what is interesting, if you increase the light pulse for 400 milliseconds, you increase the number of oscillations. So there is a direct link between the inhibition of those PV interneurons in the prefrontal cortex and the genesis of this oscillation. We did the opposite manipulation. If you present a CS plus associated with a high freezing level, you get the resetting. If you activate the PV, you block the resetting. So again, indicating that theta oscillation recorded in the prefrontal cortex are generated locally and directly mediated by PV interneurons. So what is the functional consequence of this theta resetting at the level of principal neurons? This is illustrated in this graph, where you have the oscillation in a low fear and high fear condition. So you see the oscillation, and this is the activity of principal neuron in the prefrontal cortex. And it is quite obvious that the resetting of the oscillation synchronizes the activity of principal neuron. So that's the conclusion. So we have high fear states that are associated with the theta-mediated synchronization of prefrontal output neurons. The last question of this part of the project was, what is a projection? How does it work? We got a synchronization of principal neurons in the prefrontal cortex, but how this is related to fear expression? So there is two options. Either the prefrontal cortex, there is too massive projection from the prefrontal cortex to the basolateral amygdala that has been involved in fear expression, but also the periaqueductal gray in the brainstem that is also involved in fear expression. So what we have done is we try to see if pyramidal neurons that were excited during fear presentation were projecting to the BLA or the PAG, and for this we use antidromic stimulation. So we recorded the principal neurons, and then we performed stimulation of either the BLA or the PAG to collect antidromic spike, as you can see here. Antidromic spike, they have a fixed latency, and they follow high frequency stimulation. And when you got this parameter, this indicates that the neurons you are recording from project to the structure you are stimulating. And using this strategy, we saw that the excited neuron in the prefrontal cortex, the principal neuron, they project massively to the basolateral amygdala and not the periaqueductal gray. So the conclusion of this is, resuming this scheme, we identify two types of interneuron, type 1, type 2. The PV, the type 2 are PV interneurons that contact principal neuron that project to the BLA. This is the anatomical data. Now, functionally, during CS plus presentation, I fear you have increase of type activity of type 1 interneurons that inhibit type 2 interneuron, disinhibiting prefrontal excitatory neuron. And this disinhibition, at the same time, we see the resetting of the oscillation that synchronizes the activity of those neurons projecting to the BLA. So we published that in 2014 in Nature. Okay, the conclusion of the first part of my presentation is that we identified two subpopulations of prefrontal interneurons differentially modulated during fear behavior. We identified type 2 interneurons whose inhibition is necessary and sufficient to drive fear behavior. We identify a PV interneuron-mediated disinhibitory mechanism that facilitate the principal neuron output activity during fear freezing behavior. And also we observe this local theta phase resetting during freezing that synchronizes the activity of the pyramidal neuron. So the global idea I like to bring in is that the co-occurrence of these two mechanisms, the disinhibition and the theta phase locking, synchronizes the activity of the prefrontal neurons to drive fear expression. Okay, now I will switch to the second part of my presentation that is, again, more related to not the functional role of fast-spiking interneurons, but is related to, we use them as a tool to manipulate the activity of principal neurons. And before to go into detail, I need to explain a few concepts related to rate and temporal coding. What I was just describing in this first part of the project is modulation of the firing activity of the neurons that is called a rate code mechanism. You increase the firing frequency and the general idea is that this increase in firing frequency correlates with freezing behavior. So the rate coding mechanism, there is an increase in the firing rate, is driven by sensory stimulation or disinhibitory mechanisms, and it can eventually lead to neuronal synchronization. In contrast, the temporal code is a different form of coding of information that is requiring the cooperative firing of local group of neurons, usually through the formation of neuronal assemblies. And in this particular form of coding, the precise timing of firing is important. It's not the firing frequency that is important. And one really known example of temporal code, or rather the combination of rate and temporal code, is in the spatial domain, in particularly place cells that define place field that are based on the firing frequency of the neuron. This is the first, the rate coding for place cells. But there is a second mechanism that is important. It's called the phase precession that has been really described by Michael Zugaro from the Collège de France. In the mechanism is that you, as soon as the animal move in the place field, the firing of the neuron is earlier related to theta oscillation. And in combination, these two code, the rate and the temporal code, allows the animal to know exactly where he is in his place field. So it's really a nice form of coding. What is the advantage of temporal coding over rate coding? First is about the flexibility of temporal coding. A neuron can switch between different assemblies according to sensory or external state, internal input, sorry. The organization of the spiking activity in temporal patterns can increase the coding capacity, and it is known also that the oscillations are important in this phenomenon to bind neuronal assembly, and they can coordinate the neuronal activity between distant structures. So I will now illustrate why it's important to understand temporal coding in fear behavior. What we know from our publication and publication from others is that if you play a sound, you get an activity, a strong increase, a sharp increase in the activity of the neurons in the prefrontal cortex, also in the amygdala. This is rate coding. So here there is a nice correlation between the increase, the CS onset, and the increase in firing activity. In contrast, and this is an interesting graph, this is the freezing probability during sound presentation. What you see is that to get high freezing level, is the freezing probability is not linked to the CS onset. You need always 2-3 seconds before the animal starts to freeze. So we have two conditions. The firing activity in which there is a perfect match between the CS onset and the increased activity, and the freezing behavior that is not correlated temporally with the CS onset and offset. You see also that the freezing overlasts the end of the CS presentation. So the temporal resolution between freezing and the sound presentation is really bad. So this is the general idea here is that maybe in the prefrontal cortex there is a temporal code that exists that allow to code freezing onset, freezing offset, and the freezing duration. And this is what we investigated in this project. So again, we use discriminative fear conditioning, CS minus, CS plus. The animal discriminate between the two. Interestingly, when you look at this example of freezing behavior during CS plus presentation, you see that, of course, some of the freezing occur during CS plus presentation here, but you have also spontaneously occurring fear episode. Particularly in this case. And this is quite interesting because it tells you that the occurrence of this freezing episode outside of CS presentation suggests the existence of internally generated mechanisms that could maintain the fear state independently of sensory inputs. And this is the rationale for looking at neuronal assemblies in this project. So we perform single units recording and local field potential as a first step. And this is a recording in the prefrontal cortex. We did the same thing in the basolateral amygdala. So we observe an interesting phenomenon during freezing behavior is the following one. We see the emergence of some slow oscillation specifically during freezing behavior. This is a row traces. Here on this spectrogram, what you see is the firing frequency, the frequency band during time. For the habituation session before conditioning or after conditioning during the retrieval session. In white, you have the immobility before conditioning, and here the freezing behavior after conditioning, and in blue and red is the CS minus and the CS plus presentation. So you clearly see in the prefrontal cortex that when you get freezing behavior, you have this nice oscillation that is centered around 4 Hertz. So it's between 3 and 6 Hertz, so I will call it 4 Hertz oscillation, but is of course between 3 and 6 Hertz. If you increase the temporal resolution of this, what you see is that during this freezing episode, there is almost a perfect match between the oscillation and the length of the freezing episode, which is kind of interesting. So we, if you compare habituation versus retrieval, we see an increase, of course, of the amplitude of the oscillation, what you see here for freezing episode. This is the prefrontal cortex. We see exactly the same thing in the BLA, although to a less extent because the BLA is much less organized anatomically. But we still see the four-hertz oscillation in the basolateral amygdala during freezing behavior. And again, there is a nice match between the temporal resolution of freezing behavior and this oscillation. And we see the difference between habituation and retrieval. Okay, so the question again here is whether this slow oscillation that we observe in the prefrontal cortex are linked to the hippocampus. And again, we perform the mucimolin activation of the medial septum. And you can affect, of course, the theta oscillation, but not the four-hertz oscillation. So again, the four-hertz oscillation is not directly linked to the hippocampus. Next question we ask is whether we could predict freezing behavior based on this four-hertz oscillation. And we perform this analysis where you have two spectrograms, where you have in black the envelope of the power of the local field potential for four-hertz oscillation. And what we identify is the first time point at which we have a significant change in the power in the amplitude of the oscillation during freezing behavior. So what you see is that this is freezing onset and freezing offset, and you see that you get an increase in four-hertz oscillation just before the start of the freezing episode. And for the freezing offset, the oscillation is reduced just before the start of the end, before the end of the freezing episode. So this oscillation is interesting because it could code for the freezing onset, offset, and the duration of freezing episode. So the conclusion from these two graphs is that four-hertz oscillation are first hippocampus independent, and they predict freezing onset and offset. We recorded in the prefrontal cortex and the BLA simultaneously. What we observe is that we got a synchronization of four-hertz oscillation during freezing episode. This is quite interesting as well. So this is what we call a coherogram, where you look at the coherence between the two oscillations recorded in the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala. And they were strongly coherent during freezing episode, as you can see on this graph. So the next question, which is a quick question, was related to whether the prefrontal cortex lead the amygdala, and this is what we found using Granger causality analysis. We found that the prefrontal cortex lead the oscillation. It's always the oscillation occurs always before in the prefrontal cortex and later on in the amygdala. This is the conclusion of this graph. Okay, the next and quite interesting experiment we have done is to evaluate whether the artificial optogenetic induction of the four-hertz oscillation in the prefrontal cortex is able to drive freezing behavior. And for this particular experiment, we use the PV, the fast-spiking interneurons, as a tool to manipulate the circuit. So we use the following strategy. We infected PV interneurons with the channel rhodopsin, and we know that PV interneurons massively contact principal neurons, and we impose an analog stimulation at 4 Hz to the PV oscillation. And what is the consequence of that is that you observe a 4 Hz oscillation in the prefrontal cortex that is quite matching with freezing behavior. So we artificially induce 4 Hz oscillation in the prefrontal cortex. We see the 4 Hz oscillation. And behaviorally, what you see here between the experimental group and the control group, we were able to drive freezing behavior. And this freezing behavior was long-lasting. An obvious question that was raised by many reviewers on this story is how this is specific to 4 Hz oscillation. So we designed the following control experiment where we impose different oscillation to the prefrontal cortex at different frequency. We impose the frequency at 1 Hz, 8 Hz, 10 Hz, 12 Hz, no effect. When we use a stochastic 4-hertz simulation, that is, we mixed many frequencies, but in average, we get 4-hertz oscillation, we don't see any effect. So the key point is that we need a pure 4-hertz oscillation to get this increase in freezing behavior. And the conclusion from that is that the induction of prefrontal 4-hertz oscillation drives fear behavior in a frequency-specific manner. So we have identified this nice oscillation during freezing episode. We know that the oscillation start before the freezing onset and stop before the freezing offset. This is what is summarized here. The next question we ask, and I'm almost finishing with the presentation, is does 4-hertz oscillation recruit prefrontal neurons into functional neuronal assemblies during fear behavior? As I mentioned, we record simultaneously the local field potential and the spiking activity of the neuron. What we observe is that we identify neuronal assemblies, that is, group of neurons co-activated during freezing episode. And we observe that these co-activated neurons were recurrently activated during freezing episode. So you have a group of neurons that correspond to excitatory neurons, roughly 40 to 50% of the excitatory neurons that are activated together each time you get a freezing episode for a single animal. That's the idea. So we got a subset of prefrontal neurons that are recurrently recruited into functional neural assemblies during freezing behavior. So we have the oscillation, we have those neurons, and those neural assembly, we observe an interesting phenomenon is that the neurons that participate to the neural assemblies, they are locked to the ascending phase of the oscillation. They always fire in the ascending phase of the oscillation during freezing behavior. This is what you see in this graph, where in red you have the assembly neuron firing in the ascending phase of the oscillation. In contrast, the non-assembly neuron fire everywhere. And then the final question we ask in this project is whether we can manipulate specifically this assembly neuron in the ascending phase of the oscillation, which is a critical experiment. And the response is we cannot directly manipulate these prefrontal neurons because we don't know what they are. But what we did, again, we used the PV interneurons as a tool to manipulate these neural assemblies. And here I will describe an interesting experiment we have done that is a closed-loop optogenetic manipulation of the system. The idea is that in real time we can record the freezing activity of the animal. At the same time, we can record whether there is the slow oscillation or not, and we can detect online whether we are in the ascending phase or the descending phase of the oscillation. And this computation takes roughly 10 milliseconds. We developed an algorithm to be around 10 milliseconds to detect these three parameters. So if you got these three parameters, what we did with the optogenetic stimulation of PV interneurons, again, the idea was to activate PV interneurons to block principal neuron activity specifically in the ascending phase of the oscillation. So this is an example of a trace, a road trace for Hertz oscillation, and this is the accuracy of the pulse stimulation. You see we target almost each time the ascending phase of the oscillation. So we are quite precise in manipulating specific phase of the oscillation. What is the behavioral output of this? The following one. The following first experiment was the manipulation of the ascending phase of the oscillation. So basically, if you block the firing activity of principal neurons in the ascending phase of the oscillation, you reduce completely freezing behavior. And this is the quantification here. If you do the opposite manipulation, if you manipulate in the descending phase of the oscillation, we got the opposite effect. That is an increase in freezing behavior, as you can see here. So here you may say, okay, the control group are quite different, but the experiment has been done in day 3 and day 4, and this is the normal temporal course of the freezing behavior over day 3 and day 4. So there is no bias here for the control group. So if you manipulate the neuron firing in the ascending phase of the oscillation, you reduce freezing behavior. If you manipulate them in the descending phase of the oscillation, you increase freezing behavior. And I like to discuss a bit this graph that I think is really nice. Here you have the phase of the oscillation and the percentage of rescue. A high percentage means that you reduce fear behavior. A low percentage means you increase fear behavior. And as you can see, if you manipulate the ascending phase, you decrease strongly fear behavior. In contrast, if you manipulate in the descending phase, you have the opposite effect. So that's the two conclusions I mentioned here. Inhibition of prefrontal cell neurons in the ascending phase inhibits fear behavior, but in the descending phase, it promotes fear behavior. And I will finish my presentation with this model, where we have an emitter, that is the prefrontal cortex, a receiver, that is probably the basolateral amygdala, that needs to be confirmed, and the output behavior is the freezing behavior. So under normal condition, under baseline, we have assembly neuron in red that fire in the ascending phase of the oscillation. We have non-assembly neurons that fire everywhere, and if you compute the signal-to-noise ratio for the whole cycle, what you see is that this pattern that leads to basal freezing level. Now, if we manipulate the system, if we block the assembly neurons or all the neurons in the ascending phase of the oscillation, and if you recompute the SNR, what you got is a reduction of the signal-to-noise ratio and a reduced fear responses. In contrast, if you manipulate in the ascending phase of the oscillation, if you recompute this SNR, you get a high SNR that is associated with enhanced fear responses. So altogether, we think that we have identified a phase-specific coding mechanism which dynamically regulate the MPFC neural assemblies to drive fear behavior. And to my knowledge, this is the first demonstration of a causal role of a temporal coding in fear behavior. So the conclusion, you already got them. I insist on the identification of these phase-specific coding mechanisms. And with this, I would like to thank the people of my lab that performed this experiment, in particular Cyril Dejean, that is postdoc in my lab, Julien Courtin, that is at the FMI in Basel now, my collaborators that work on with me on that project, Nicolas Caralis, Anton Sirota, Karim Benchanan, and Sophie Bagger, and I thank you for your attention.